Hello all, so glad to be back on somewhat of a regular schedule again. I'm your host Crystal, here for another rousing episode of Crime and Tea. If you're new, hello, welcome, and if you're not new, welcome back, so glad to have you joining me here today. We will be delving into a Down Under case today, starting off in Tasmania, Australia. So let's just jump on in, grab your tea, your coffee, or something cozy, and let's do it. So we begin with the birth of Martin John Bryant on May 7, 1967 at the Queen Alexandra Hospital located in Hobart, Tasmania. He was the firstborn of Maurice and Carlene Bryant. Martin was described by his mother as being difficult and annoying with his behavior, often finding his toys broken, and he just didn't act like a normal child. During his school time, it was actually noted that he had an IQ of only 66, which I also read might have been 64. I don't know if it really makes a difference, but 66 was the most common number that popped up, which is indicative of a mental disorder. He is actually later properly diagnosed with Asperger's, but that's not until after all of the bad shit happens. Teachers said of him that he was very emotionally detached and would often exhibit incorrect emotions in many instances. He was very disruptive in class, and he would often become violent for no apparent reason. In culmination with these issues, he was also severely bullied. Among these other issues, Bryant would also cut down neighbors' trees, because that's, you know, normal and all, as well as torturing small animals, which we all know is a bad sign. At the age of 14, his father gifted him an air rifle, because, you know, that's also a great idea, which he loved. However, he would use it to shoot at traffic, and at one point he would actually kill a parrot with it. His odd behavior continued until his adulthood, or into his adulthood, with his father even taking an early retirement to take care of him. Although short-lived, his father had committed suicide. It is said by Bryant this was due to his father not being able to purchase the home he was renting. However, that is unknown. It was even speculated prior to a suicide ruling that Bryant might have actually had a hand in his father's death. However, he was ultimately ruled out, and the suicide was the decided cause of death. As far as work goes, Bryant didn't do too much, a bit of handiwork and some gardening here and there. He was also granted a disability pension due to his low IQ, which he lived off for quite some time. One of his jobs ended up with Bryant meeting Helen Harvey. She was an heiress to a share in the Tattersall's lottery fortune. Harvey at this point decided to befriend the young Bryant. Once Helen's mother had passed, she asked him to move in with her, which is weird. She would take him shopping and spend enormous amounts of money, spoiling her young handyman. There was much speculation that there was something more going on between the pair, which was very off-putting to the neighbors. However, that was never confirmed. It seemed the heiress may have just been lonely, as she was 54 upon meeting the then 19-year-old Bryant. Now, Helen wasn't completely immune to knowing something was a little off with Bryant, as she had said he made her very nervous at times with his erratic behavior. She had actually said that the little bastard was going to end up killing her with his bouts of taking the wheel whilst Helen was driving. They'd been in multiple crashes, and Helen purposefully drove slower in fear of this occurring. Ultimately, she was right to be afraid. Although not proven, much speculation surrounds her death. October 20th, 1992, the pair had gotten into a fatal car crash for the heiress and her two dogs. Bryant was taken to the hospital and treated. He claimed it was the dogs running loose in the car that actually caused the accident. Helen had left her entire estate to the young Bryant, giving him over roughly $500,000 and multiple properties. That wasn't including the $250,000 left to him by his father. Needless to say, Bryant had plenty of money, just no one to share it with. And I also wanted to note that Bryant's father may have died afterwards, after the whole Helen thing, but I wasn't quite sure on that, so it was one or the other, but he ended up with these large sums of money, nevertheless. He would end up using a lot of his money for traveling. It was something he really wanted to enjoy. It seems though he much preferred the plane rides themselves, as the people around him were more forced into being polite with the eccentric young man. He traveled to many countries trying to be social and make friends, but to no avail. People treated him just the same, no matter where he'd go. His mother also implemented a trustee to manage the fortune he had acquired so as to not have him blow through all of the funds. It seems he sought some psychiatric help, to which he was prescribed prothioidine, an antidepressant, but there wasn't too much information on that. Later in 1995, it was said that Bryant became suicidal, not fitting in, and having no one to spend time with was taking a toll on him, taking a toll on his already strained mental state. This is around when he began drinking more regularly. He began to daily drink about half a bottle of Sambuca, a bottle of Bailey's Irish Cream, port wine, and other sweet alcoholic beverages. This is when things would really take a turn, if not for the earlier Dunblane massacre that was all over the news just weeks before Brian's incident, which was a shooting by Thomas Hamilton at the Dunblane Primary School in the UK, which I'll probably cover in the future. Brian had seemed to have all but given up till this point, and it seems this attack resonated with him. It was speculated his actions were to get attention, as a neighbor had noted that Brian said, "I'll do something that will make everyone remember me." This is when he just seems to snap. April 28th, 1996, Bryant decides he's going to take out his frustrations after a seemingly premeditated few days checking out the Port Arthur area. Bryant makes his move. He first goes to the home of David and Nolene Martin, who actually purchased the Seascape bed and breakfast that Bryant's father had wanted to purchase. He fatally shoots the Martins in their home. Then he decides to head over to the Port Arthur area, where he decides he's going to stop for lunch at the Broad Arrow Cafe with a large blue duffel bag in hand. Upon completing his meal, he moves to the back of the cafe. Here he sets a video camera on the counter. Then he takes out his Colt AR-15 SP-1 carbine semi-automatic rifle. He opened fire on the unsuspecting patrons and staff, just blindingly firing off. It took only 15 seconds for him to get off 17 rounds, which killed 12 and wounded 10. This was not the end, though, not by a long shot. He walked to the other side of the shop and once again opened fire again, killing another 8 and wounding 2 more. He proceeded to reload and leave the shop. As he did so, he continued with his assault from the parking lot as well as his drive in his yellow Volvo 224. He killed another 4 and injured 6 more. He drove approximately 300 meters away, where he saw a woman and her two young children. He shot at the woman and the child she was carrying, killing them. He then got out and shot the other child, who was trying to flee. Then I guess he thought he needed a different vehicle, so he procured a BMW after he shot and killed all 4 of the occupants of the vehicle first. He then traveled a short bit down the road and noticed a couple in a Toyota. He stopped and drew his weapon, ordering the male to get into his car and proceeding to shoot the female through the car window. He then returned to where it all started, back to the Seascape's guest house. He lit the stolen vehicle on fire and took his hostage into the home with him. It didn't take long for the police to start negotiations with Bryant. Bryant was on the phone for hours, long enough for the battery on his device to die. His hostage was killed in the midst of the negotiations. Apparently, he wanted a military-grade helicopter to take him to the airport, like that was going to happen. 18 hours later, the following morning, he decided to try and escape. He thought he would set fire to the home and escape in the confusion. He was obviously captured at this point, where he was taken to Royal Hobart Hospital for burns to his bottom and his back. He was heavily guarded and treated for his wounds. In total, he killed 35 people and badly injured another 23 people. Now, I went through his confession transcript, and they go through how Bryant procured his weapons and the events of the day. They start talking to Bryant, and they ask him where he got his Daewoo 12-gauge shotgun. He goes on to say he bought it off of Terry Hill, who was a local guns and ammo stop. He bought the guns and ammo for $3,000. He said he got that one about 3 months prior, but never used it. It then goes on where they find the Colt AR-15 with a scope, ammo, and a strap that he also bought off of Terry Hill for $5,000, was bought 5 months prior. He goes on to ask if Terry Hill was still in business after some more talk about the AR. Officer Payne asks why he asks, and Brian says because he didn't have a license. They go on to say Terry never asked for his license. Brian always paid in cash. He always dealt directly with Terry, and he never got a receipt. Being that Bryant always paid in cash, if he didn't have the money, he would have to make a request to his trustee, and then the money would send to him. He goes on saying he could only get money out every 3 months. It's also found this is when he got his duffel bag that he denied purchasing. They go over all the weapons purchased and the events that transpired, with Bryant eventually confessing, because he was literally trying to say he didn't do it. He was a rough interviewee to go through. Bryant's thoughts are not fluent, and he has a lot of trouble managing through the interview. He was, however, deemed fit to stand trial, so November 9th, 1996, he was trying to plead not guilty, but his court-appointed lawyer, John Avery, advised him to plead guilty. 2 weeks later, he was sentenced by Judge William Cox of the Hobart Supreme Court to 35 sentences, plus 1,652 years in prison, with no possibility of parole, and the terms were to be concurrently served. He will be in a mental institution for the rest of his life. He served his first 18 months in near solitary confinement in a suicide prevention cell. He was in protective custody till November 13th, 2006, for his own safety. He then went to the Hobart's Wilfred Lopez Center for Mental Health, run by the Tasmanian Department of Health and Human Services. This was a free-roaming unit with medical staff pretty much everywhere. There was also a three-wall exterior with private contract guards. March 27, 2007, Bryant tried to slit his own wrists, which, why can he get a hold of a razor blade, but whatever. Then March 27th, he cut his throat with a razor again. He was hospitalized briefly, and he now resides at the Risdon Maximum Security Prison near Hobart. He is now 54 years old, and his favorite thing to do is to eat. So much so that in exchange for snacks, he is known to do sexual favors. And he just eats all the time. There was a memorial erected called the Port Arthur Memorial Garden, which features a pool of peace that loved ones can mourn their losses at. If you go to the first link below, all of the victims are listed on the memorial website. This incident also spiked the Australian government to enact the National Firearms Agreement just 12 days after the incident. Automatic rapid-fire weapons were completely outlawed. There were about 650,000 assault weapons bought back by the government at a cost of $230 million. There was also a movie loosely based off of Bryant called Nitram. I'm not sure how accurately it portrays him, but I read there were clear similarities to Bryant. However, I've never seen it, so I have no clue. And that's it for Martin Bryant. So thanks for sticking around with me, everyone. I do hope you enjoyed your time with me today. I know this was definitely a grim case, but I hope it didn't bring you down too far. It was definitely crazy going through it all myself. If you want, you can check out the Instagram for pics at Crime and Tea. You can also shoot me an email at crimeandteapodcast@gmail.com with any comments, questions, or whatever you'd like to say. You can also use the Anchor link down below to make a donation if you feel so inclined to do so. And thanks again, guys. Till next time's tea. Bye!